Chapter 2, The Existential Experience of the Will. The experience of the will constitutes both a firm foundation and a strong incentive for starting the exacting but most rewarding task of its training. It occurs in three phases. The first is the recognition that the will exists. The second concerns the realization of having a will. The third phase of the discovery, which renders it complete and effective, is that of being a will. This is different from having a will. This discovery of the will is hard to describe. As is true of any experience, it cannot be fully communicated by words, but the paths leading to it and the conditions favoring it can be indicated. The analogy to the discovery of beauty, to the arousal of the aesthetic sense, may be illuminating. A revelation occurs, an awakening, which may come when one looks at the delicate hue of the sky at sunset, at a majestic range of snow-capped mountains, or into the clear eyes of a child. It may come while contemplating the cryptic smile of Leonardo's Gioconda. It may come while listening to the music of Bach or Beethoven, or while reading the inspired verses of great poets. This awakened sense of the beautiful, though often faint and confused at first, becomes clearer and develops through repeated experiences of an aesthetic nature, and can also be cultivated and refined through the study of aesthetics and the history of art. But no amount of intellectual consideration and study can, of itself, take the place of the initial revelation. The awakening can be facilitated and often brought about by creating favorable circumstances for this purpose. For instance, by the quiet and repeated contemplation of natural scenery and works of art, or by opening oneself to the charm of music. The same is true of the will. At a given moment, perhaps during a crisis, one has a vivid and unmistakable inner experience of its reality and nature. When danger threatens to paralyze us, suddenly, from the mysterious depths of our being, surges an unsuspected strength which enables us to place a firm foot on the edge of the precipice or confront an aggressor calmly and resolutely. Before the threatening attitude of an unfair superior or when facing an excited mob, when personal reasons would induce us to yield, the will gives us the power to say resolutely, "No. At all costs, I stand by my convictions. I will perform what I take to be right." Similarly, when assailed by some insinuating and seducing temptation, the will raises us, shaking us out of our acquiescence and freeing us from the snare. The inner experience of willing may also come in other, more quiet and subtle ways. During periods of silence and meditation, in the careful examination of our motives, in moments of thoughtful deliberation and decision, a voice, small but distinct, will sometimes make itself heard, urging us to a specific course of action and prompting which is different from that of our ordinary motives and impulses. We feel that it comes from the central core of our being, or else an inner illumination makes us aware of the reality of will with an overwhelming conviction that asserts itself irresistibly. However, the simplest and most frequent way in which we discover our will is through determined action and struggle. When we make a physical or mental effort, when we are actively wrestling with some obstacle or coping with opposing forces, we feel a specific power rising up within us, and this energy gives us the experience of willing. Let us realize thoroughly the full meaning and immense value of the discovery of the will. In whatever way it happens, either spontaneously or through conscious action, in a crisis or in the quiet of inner recollection, it constitutes a most important and decisive event in our lives. The discovery of the will in oneself, and even more, the realization that the self and the will are intimately connected, may come as a real revelation which can change, often radically, a man's self-awareness and his whole attitude towards himself, other people, and the world. He perceives that he is a living subject, endowed with the power to choose, to relate, to bring about changes in his own personality, in others, in circumstances. This enhanced awareness, this awakening and vision of new, unlimited potentialities for inner expansion and outer action, gives a new feeling of confidence, security, joy, a sense of wholeness. But this initial revelation, this inner light, however vivid and inspiring at the moment of its occurrence, is apt to grow dim and to flicker out or give only intermittent flashes. The new awareness of self and will becomes easily submerged by the constant surge of drives, desires, emotions, and ideas. It is crowded out by the ceaseless inrush of impressions from the outer world. Thus, the need to protect, cultivate, and strengthen the initial attainment becomes evident, in order to make it a constant possession and utilize its great possibilities. But when one puts oneself to the task, one finds oneself confronted by difficulties and experiencing resistance. The first resistance is often due to the current misunderstanding of the nature and function of the will. The Victorian conception of the will still prevails, a conception of something stern and forbidding, which condemns and represses most of the other aspects of human nature. But such a misconception might be called a caricature of the will. The true function of the will is not to act against the personality drives to force accomplishment of one's purposes. The will has a directive and regulatory function. It balances and constructively utilizes all the other activities and energies of the human being without repressing any of them. The function of the will is similar to that performed by the helmsman of a ship. He knows what the ship's course should be and keeps her steadily on it, despite the drifts caused by wind and current. But the power he needs to turn the wheel is altogether different from that required to propel the ship through the water, whether it be generated by engines, the pressure of the winds on the sail, or the efforts of rowers. Another form of resistance comes from the generally prevailing tendency towards inertia, to let the easygoing side of one's nature take control, to allow inner impulses or external influences to dominate the personality. It may be summed up as an unwillingness to take the trouble, to pay the price demanded by a worthwhile undertaking. This often holds true for the development of the will, but it cannot reasonably be expected that the training of the will can be accomplished without the expenditure of effort and persistence required for the successful development of any other quality, whether physical or mental. And such effort is more than worthwhile, because the use of the will is at the basis of every activity. Therefore, a more developed will improves the effectiveness of all future endeavors. After the conviction, the certainty that the will exists and that one has a will is acquired, comes the realization of the close, intimate connection between the will and the self. This culminates in the existential experience of pure self-consciousness. In the direct awareness of the self, the discovery of the I. In reality, this experience is implicit in our human consciousness. It is that which distinguishes it from that of animals, which are conscious but not self-conscious. Animals are conscious. They clearly show this in their emotional reactions to situations and their affective relations with human beings. Human beings go beyond mere animal awareness and know that they are aware. But generally, the self-consciousness is indeed implicit rather than explicit. It is experienced in a rather nebulous and distorted way because it is usually mixed with and veiled by the contents of consciousness, sensations, drives, emotions, thoughts, etc. Their constant impact veils the clarity of consciousness and produces spurious identification of the self with these changing and transient contents. Thus, if we are to make self-consciousness explicit, clear, and vivid, we must disidentify ourselves from all these contents and identify with the self. It is possible to achieve this realization by means of certain kinds of meditation, but particularly by the use of the exercise of self-identification, which is given in my book, Psychosynthesis, and quoted here in Appendix 1, page 211. For the convenience of the reader. Self-consciousness, or awareness of the self, has two characteristics, one introspective, the other dynamic. This can be expressed in various ways. For instance, I am aware of being unwilling, or in that I am, I can will. This intimate relationship between the I and the will, between being and willing, has been clearly set forth by Professor Kahlo in his article on the will in the Italian Encyclopedia. Volitional activity is in close connection with the consciousness of the I, as both an active and unifying center of all the elements of psychic life. The I, which is at first an obscure subjectivity, a point of reference of every psychic experience, affirms itself gradually as it succeeds in distinguishing itself as a source of activity from every one of its particular elements, feelings, tendencies, instincts, ideas. The will is just this activity of the I, which is a unity, which stands above the multiplicity of its contents, which replaces the previous impulsive, fractional, centrifugal action of these contents. I and will are correlated terms. The I exists insofar as it has its own specific capacity for action, which is the will, and the will exists only as a distinctive and autonomous activity of the I. And there's a note down the bottom of this page, reference that excerpt, saying reference notes begin on page 263. It is well to become aware of the relationships between the self and the will on one hand, and the various other psychological functions on the other. This awareness may be clarified by the diagram on page 13. So what we have here is a six-pointed star, which I guess you could call it the petal of the star, is a part of ourselves, a function of ourselves. One begins at the bottom, facing south, sensation. Then moving in a clockwise direction, we have emotion, feeling as number two. Moving back to southeast, we have impulse and desire, number three. And then northwest, we have number four, imagination. Then northeast, we have number five, thought. And then facing true north, we have six, intuition. In the midst of the petals, we have a circle, number seven, will, with a capital W, and then a large dot in the middle, self, with a capital S, is number eight. So to review, one, sensation. Two, emotion or feeling. Three, impulse or desire. Four, imagination. Five, thought. Six, intuition. Seven, will. Eight, the central point, the I or the personal self. The will has been placed at the center of the diagram in direct contact with the conscious I or personal self to show the close connection between them. Through the will, the I acts on the other psychological functions, regulating and directing them. The diagram is oversimplified, like all diagrams, but it helps give prominence to the central position of the will. But there remains a further step that can be taken, a further discovery that can be made, that of the relationship between the I and the transpersonal or higher self, of which the I is a reflection or projection. This relationship is depicted on the diagram on page 14 of the Psychological Constitution of Man. The I is indicated by the point at the center of the field of awareness, while the transpersonal self is represented by a star at the apex of the superconscious. I will not dwell further on this here, because the subject is dealt with in the chapter on transpersonal will, which is a function of the transpersonal self. To begin the discussion of the training of the will requires laying some conceptual groundwork. Because of the richness of the subject, I hope the reader will bear with me in the elaboration of categories in describing the will. These categories are necessary to get a complete picture of the fully developed will, and most important, to get a purchase on training such an important human attribute. Before I continue, on this page 14 we're on now is the egg diagram, which Roberto mentioned just previous. So imagine an egg, but the egg drawn with dotted lines, so a fluid thing. You have the conical, I suppose it is, shape of an egg, and those who know psychosynthesis will be well aware of this particular model, central as it is to psychosynthesis. and we have the lower unconscious in the bottom third. Now, these days we tend to call that the basic unconscious. Then in the middle third, we have the middle unconscious. We sometimes call that the middle ground these days. And then three, on the top third of the diagram, we have the higher unconscious, or the superconscious. Then we have number four, which is a circle in the middle, right in the middle of the middle third. It's its own circle, which is called the field of consciousness. In that circle, we have a dot right in the middle, which we call the conscious self, or the I. Six is a large star at the top of the diagram, the transpersonal self. And then seven is the area entirely outside the circle, interacting with the edges of the circle, the collective unconscious. Moving back to the reading. I shall use these three categories or dimensions in describing the will: aspects, qualities, and stages. The first category, aspects, is the most basic and represents the facets that can be recognized in the fully developed will. The second category, qualities, refers to the expression of the will. These are the modes of expression of the will in action. Finally, the stages of the will refer specifically to the process of willing, the act of will as it unfolds from beginning to end. The fully developed will can be thought of as having a number of different major aspects. These should be thought of as principal facets of our main subject, the major elements in the outline of the will. Each of these aspects can be trained in specific and appropriate ways. Because the bulk of part one of this volume is concerned with these major aspects, it is well to outline them at once. The aspects of the fully developed human will are the strong will, the skillful will, and the good will, and the transpersonal will. Let me describe these principal aspects of the will briefly, so that the reader can have them in mind as we continue to outline the phenomenology of the will in other regards. 1. Strong will. As we have previously mentioned, to train the will, one must start by recognizing that the will exists, then that one has a will, and finally that one is a will, or essentially a willing self. Then one has to develop the will to make it strong enough to be adequate for its manifold uses in all the domains of life. Most misunderstandings and mistakes concerning the will arise from the frequent misconception that the strong will constitutes the whole will. Strength is only one of the aspects of the will, and when dissociated from the others, it can be, and often is, ineffectual or harmful to oneself and other people. 2. The skillful will. The skillful aspect of the will consists of the ability to obtain desired results with the least possible expenditure of energy. In order to go somewhere, one does not proceed by walking in a straight line across open country or by climbing over buildings. One rather studies a road map and uses existing roads, which, although not in a straight line, can lead one to his destination with the least amount of effort. And one takes advantage of already existing means of transportation, that is, of vehicles that are going in the direction he has chosen. Similarly, in order to use our will most skillfully, we need to understand our inner constitution, becomes acquainted with our many different functions, desires, habit patterns, and the relationships between them, so that at any one time we can activate and utilize those aspects of ourselves that already have the tendency to produce the specific action or condition we are aiming for. Goodwill. Even when the will is endowed with both strength and skill, it is not always satisfactory. In fact, it may even be a harmful weapon, for if such a will is directed toward evil ends, it becomes a serious danger to society. A man of strong and able will, capable of using his natural gifts to the utmost, can overpower or corrupt the will of others. One who dares everything, fears nothing, and whose actions are not restrained by any ethical consideration, by any sense of love or compassion, can have a disastrous influence on a community, or even an entire nation. There are two great laws which operate in the physical and the psychological worlds: the law of action and reaction, and the law of rhythm and equilibrium. Through their operation, Those who cause harm attract harm upon themselves. Those who are violent and merciless ultimately evoke the violence and cruelty of others against themselves. History offers many such examples, from Caligula to Rasputin to Hitler. Because of the working of these laws, the will, to be fulfilling, must be good. Thus, goodwill is both desirable and ultimately inevitable. It may therefore be stated that learning to choose right goals is an essential aspect of training the will. It is necessary both for the general welfare and for our own, that our will be good as well as strong and skillful. All this is the specific field of interpersonal, group, and social psychosynthesis. 4. The transpersonal will. The three aspects of the will so far mentioned seem to constitute the totality of characteristics of the will. This may be true for the normal human being, in whom they suffice for his self-actualization, and for leading a rich and useful life. This represents the aim of personal and interpersonal psychosynthesis. But there is another dimension in man. Though many are unaware of it, and may even deny its existence, there is another kind of awareness, to the reality of which the direct experience of a number of individuals has testified throughout history. The dimension along which this awareness functions can be termed vertical. In the past, it was generally considered the domain of religious or spiritual experience, but it is now gaining increasing recognition as a valid field of scientific investigation. This specific domain of transpersonal psychology, which deals with what Maslow, a pioneer in his field, has called the higher needs, in the words of the Statement of Purpose of the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, its concern is with meta-needs, ultimate values, unitive consciousness, peak experiences, ecstasy, mystical experience, being, values, essence, bliss, awe, wonder, self-actualization, ultimate meaning, transcendence of the self, spirit, sacralization of everyday life, oneness, cosmic awareness, cosmic play, individual and species-wide synergy, maximal interpersonal encounter, transcendental phenomena, maximal sensory awareness, responsiveness and expression, and related concepts, experiences, and activities. This is the realm or dimension of the transpersonal will, which is the will of the transpersonal self. It is also the field of the relationship between each individual, between the will of the personal self, or I, and the will of the transpersonal self. This relationship leads to a growing interplay between, and ultimately to the fusion of the personal and transpersonal selves, and in turn to their relationship with the ultimate reality, the universal self, which embodies and demonstrates the universal, transcendent will. End of chapter 2.